right. It's great to be with you guys this morning. Band, thanks a lot. You know, they're from Biola, so that Biola bands are great. I'm a Biola grad, so I just got to sit there and be excited about you guys even more. So any other Biola grads or Talbot grads out there? Right on. That's not too many. We need more than that here. You know, I was just sitting there counting. 22 years I've been a part of Hume Lake. I started on summer staff. Some of my favorite times were working in the over in Meadow Ranch in Cedar Hall. Are there any Cedar Hall dishwashers here? Right on. Did multiple years there. Got to work at Wagon Train. Got to work at Wildwood. Got a chance to work in some of the different camps. And Hume is just a place that, it's just a sweet place. And I know if you're on staff right now, you might be a little bit tired. But you know what? God's doing big things. And he chooses to use this place to do them. Which is just an amazing, it's amazing we get to be a part of something God's doing. And so I always tell people, they go, what's the will for my life? I go, find out where God's working and just jump in. And that's really God's will, is to be a part of what he's all about. So for 22 years, this had been home. And then I'll tell you a little bit of my story as we go on, but my family and I packed up and moved to Michigan just recently. And I know you're sitting there going, why would you do that? But this is my family. I've got my wife Becky, my daughter Ellie, and then Ronan and Jaron in Carmel. And this is a picture of us a couple years ago at the lake. And you look at us, we look so happy. But you, if you have kids, you all know that this is really what the picture, come on. Here's really what's going on, you know, in real pictures. Ronan's about to kill something, Carmel's going to run off, you know, and yeah, family photos are always a difficult thing. But Hume Lake has been a huge part of our lives. My parents met here years ago, and so we've always vacationed here, and then we came on staff. My wife and I up here, my brothers have all worked here. And coming up here yesterday was just a fun moment because a couple of my brothers were up here with their families, and my mom was here, and it's just a special place where a lot of memories have been made. And so you guys are, you're in a place where God's moving and working, and we're excited to be up here with you this week as well. We moved out to Michigan in August of this last year, and I know you're sitting there going, why would you move to Michigan? Sometimes God calls you away from heaven on earth, and you have to go somewhere else. So we said goodbye to Hume Lake after 15 years of raising our family here and moved out to Michigan, where I'm getting a chance to work with pastors and take people to the Middle East on biblical study tours, which, again, is a pretty fun thing to do, but leaving Hume was tough. We've tried to embrace the Dutch culture because we're in a place called Holland, Michigan. So, whole lot of Dutch going on. We are not Dutch. Our last name is Ferreira. There's nothing further from Dutch than Ferreira. I've been trying to add a Van Ferreira, you know, a little van on the front of it just to fit in. But Holland, Michigan, you know, they love their Dutch culture. They love their tulip time, and we're just trying to fit in as best we can. But Michigan is a great place. I mean, this was a morning I woke up to, God giving me a sunrise, and I was just like, sweet, Michigan, you're doing it for me, you know, with an awesome morning sunrise. And, you know, God's everywhere, which is the beautiful thing, you know, wherever we head to. And we've enjoyed our journey out there so far, and I'm excited to be able to teach with you guys this week. So being at Hume for years, you have so many stories, so I got to give one. And I ran the Joshua Institute for 10 years, and with the Joshua Institute, you've got about 56 students, they're there for a year, and they get into all kinds of trouble during the time, which makes for great stories. And so this particular, yeah, if you're a current student, be nice to Bob, all right? Just be nice to him. This is a picture I just found from years ago, and I apologize because it was shot on the very first iPhone that came out, so you can see the technology difference over the years. But we do a lot of trips, and so we were on a trip, and we were down in the San Francisco area, and we were doing Habitat for Humanity, and being the boss, you basically end up spending your time running people to the emergency room. I mean, that's pretty much what my trips always ended up being, and the morning starts off, first day on the job, we go, we eat breakfast, we head out, and not more than like 30 minutes into being there, one of my staff comes, and we're like, hey, Johnny stepped on a nail. Awesome. This is going to be an ER visit, which means we're going to be there a long time because we are not going to be a priority whatsoever. So I go to Johnny and I go, Johnny, have you had a tetanus shot? What's that? you learn things. After that, we actually started like finding these things out ahead of time and making sure people had their shots. Come to find out from Johnny, I mean, really great kid, he doesn't take medicine at all. And so he's never really ever taken medicine, and he doesn't know if he's ever had a tetanus shot. We can't get a hold of his parents. So here we go. We're going to go get a tetanus shot. We get to the hospital, and we're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and his foot hurts, and he's just sitting there. And finally, I get a phone call, so I step out. And I come back, and Johnny is sitting in kind of the waiting room-ish area, and he's like, hey, a nurse came by, and she gave me some medicine. I'm like, well, what kind of medicine did she give you? And he's like, I don't know. She gave me something called Vicodin. How many did she give you, Johnny? Two. How many did you take? Both. Rewind a little bit. The guy's never taken medicine before, ever. I mean, Advil, nothing. He just didn't take medicine. Two, he didn't eat breakfast that morning. Come to find out. So he's got nothing in his tummy. And so here he is sitting in, he's just drugged out now at this point. And so I've got Johnny sitting there, and we're sitting in this kind of area where people are walking by, and he's telling his story to everyone. It's fantastic at this point. And telling everybody his story, and then I'm sitting right next to him. I stood up to take a picture, but I was sitting next to him on this like little cot thing. And he would be sitting there, and all of a sudden he'd just be like, and I've only known Johnny for like a month. Look right at me. Hey, Rich. Yeah, Johnny? I love you. I love you too, Johnny. And he would do this back and forth thing, and it was great. So finally, we get out of there after being there for a few hours. I'm like, I got to get some food in this kid's stomach because he is hallucinating. He's going nuts. So I take him to a Wendy's, I think it was, and we sit down, and I get him a hamburger, and I leave to go get his drink because I wasn't going to trust him to go fill it up himself. So I go to fill it up, and I come back, and he is talking to his sandwich. One of the most profound conversations I've ever heard to a hamburger or to a person for that matter. The hamburger came to know the Lord twice during the time, and I was impressed by it. So if that wasn't good enough, I then got a phone call saying, hey, we need you to go run and get some like material stuff we need. So I end up at Costco, and I give Johnny a cart. And you have never seen such awesomeness on a cart. The guy was still drugged up, driving a cart around, trying to steal all of the like freebies he could get. At one point, I couldn't find him. He had tucked it into like a spot he was hiding in, and we had to like search the store for the guy. The fun of being in ministry, right? I'm glad Johnny's not here because he would probably have words to say about this if he could remember it. Anyway, we're going to actually open our Bibles this morning. So if you can open your Bible to Matthew chapter 16, that's where we're going to be. And if you get a chance to join me this week, and I hope you will if you've got the time in the evening, we're going to do a series called Jesus in His Context. And what's going to be fun with this is that I've always had this saying to people that there are five Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the land of the Bible. Because the land of the Bible brings together so many things that you and I take for granted, culture, geography, just all the ritual stuff that happens, because that was assumed by the writers that you understood it. But we've gotten a little bit away from that, and so we don't always understand the culture of the time. And so we're going to put Jesus back into the culture of the first century and hopefully have some fun with some different stories that you've heard. And I'm going to give you a little snapshot of that this morning. Matthew 16 says, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples probably the most important question in the entire Bible. Who do people say the Son of Man is? And so we're going to get into this moment of this answer, but the first question to us as readers should be, why Caesarea Philippi? Where is this place? And so we're going to do a little bit of background context really quick, and hopefully this will open up for you just a little bit more fun and understanding as we look at this thing I call the fifth gospel. So we're going to look at a place called Caesarea Philippi. So Jesus, and again, I'm sorry, maps are a little tough to read when they're that far away. Jesus takes his guys from the area of the Galilee, and he takes them, let's see if my laser pointer, doesn't really work. Anyway, he takes them to that region up there that looks pink, towards the top, and that is Caesarea Philippi. It's about 25 miles if you could just fly that direction, but really it'll take probably 2 to 3 days to walk because roads are never straight. And so Jesus, it just says, he's in the Galilee with his disciples, and then he says, in the next part it says, and then he goes to the region of Caesarea Philippi, and he makes his way up there. During the time of the first century when this is being written, when Jesus is ministering, you've got Herod the Great, he has died. And so now you've got his three sons who are ruling the area. And in the area in the pink up there is ran by his son Herod Philip. Hence, the area he's in is Caesarea Philippi, which is the capital city of Herod Philip. And it's also got the name Caesarea on it, which tells you that it's a Roman province, because he's made a place to basically honor Rome, the patrons who keep them in business, basically. So we get this location they head to. Again, here's another little piece here. The very bottom of the screen is the Sea of Galilee. And as you make your way up, you get to a spot that says Caesarea Philippi. It's on the border of modern-day Lebanon and modern-day Syria. So if you go there today, you're right in this hotspot location. It's on the road from Damascus, so it's an important, important city. And so Jesus heads there. Now, in the first century, if you were a Jewish person, you didn't go to Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi was not the place where you would want your children spending time. And I'm going to walk you through a little bit of that. But when you get up there, and these are some of our Joshua students, Caesarea Philippi is an amazing location. When you think of Israel, everyone thinks of desert and they think of sand, but Israel is like California. There's a whole lot of everything inside of it. You've got mountains, you've got desert, you've got beach, you've got all of it. And Caesarea Philippi is up on a major water area. This is what feeds the Jordan River. And so it's lush, it's green, it's plentiful. It's an amazing spot. And in the time of the first century, it was a metropolitan location that people wanted to be at. And so again, this is Caesarea Philippi here, and if you look towards the back of it, you see that little cave kind of section. That's what we're going to be talking about, that area. This is the main part of Caesarea Philippi. I always like drawings to help you out a little bit. That rock section is where it says Grotto of Pan in the back area over there. And in the time of a guy by the name of Alexander the Great, he was a Greek, he makes his way through the land, and we're talking about 330, 350 BC, so a long time before Jesus. He's making his way, and he's conquering the known world of the time. And the way that he would conquer the world is as he would bring his armies through. If his men were done with their army service, he would pay them out by giving them land. And then they would set up that area, and they would set it up in the name of Alexander the Great. And so here is a location where Alexander's people came through. It was lush, it was nice, it was an amazing location. And so as they conquered this area, he left people there who were Greeks. And so these Greeks began to set up Greek gods. And one of those gods is a god by the name of Pan. And so this area has been known as Panias or Banias, because in Arabic it's hard to say the P, so they say B, so Banias. And this area was worshiping a certain god. And that god was the god named Pan. And this is nothing new, because even in life today, cities or locations take on importance by what's there, whether it's trade or whether it's religion. And in this particular place here, Pan is the main centerpiece of the entire city. Maybe you remember from reading about Paul as he travels to Ephesus, there was the Artemis of the Ephesians. Artemis was worshipped all over the place, but Ephesus was the main location of it. Pan is a god that's worshipped all over, but this is its main location. Maybe think today when you think of the Catholic Church, you probably think of the Vatican, you think of Rome. If you think of the Jewish people, you think of Jerusalem. If you think of Islam, you might think of Saudi Arabia and Mecca. Locations that have a significant religious tie to them. This is where Pan worship originates, or where its infrastructure is at. And so Jesus is going to take his guys to a location that is extremely pagan. I want to tell you a little bit about Pan before we get into reading the scripture part. Caesarea Philippi, if I were to make a statement of it, it was kind of like the Las Vegas of its time. There was always that, I don't know if you remember that saying that was, what happens in Vegas, what? Stays in Vegas. It's like this idea of, come to Vegas, do whatever you want, no one has to know. Going to Caesarea Philippi was the same thing. You were going to a location where all your wants, desires, anything that you wanted to fulfill as far as what you needed, you could get it there. And for Jewish boys and girls, you're told that there are things that are just wrong. But when you go to Caesarea Philippi, anything goes. And so this is a location where people are basically creating a religious system to meet their own needs. And so when you talk about Pan and Pan worship, it's very sexual. it's very, like, again, it's, what do people want in their life? Oh, Pan says it's okay, so therefore we can do it. So here's, just so you can see, Pan. Pan was the Greek and Roman god of shepherds and goat herders. He's associated with fertility, and he's the son of Hermes from the Greek god kind of like mythology that goes on with that. And so here is this god, and you know, I remember as a kid watching cartoons where this mythical creature who was half man, half goat would play a flute and like call people out. That's Pan. Had no idea as a kid I was watching cartoons that had Pan. So, Mom, I don't know what you were showing me when I was a kid. But Pan is this person who gathers people together, and he is a fertility god. And remember, they live in a very fertile place. If you're living in this area, you notice how green and lush it is. And there's this big cave towards the back, and you can kind of see it back there, and that's where the water would come out from the ground. It came out from underneath Mount Hermon. And in a Greek perspective, and even a Jewish one as well, they would believe that a place like this is an entrance into the underground, into hell, if you want to call it that. Hell's somewhere down below. How do you get there? Well, caves, places that we don't understand where it comes from, that's where you get into the underground of hell. And so Pan would live in this area here, and since his father was Hermes, every single year Hermes is the messenger between the underworld and the life, the world that has life in it. Pan would go down with his dad down into hell, and he would be down there. And so he'd basically be dead. And so his people who followed him, who followed Pan, they would have to make him resurrect. They'd have to make him want to come back from the underworld and come back and bring fertility. And so they would do whatever it took. And so it was, again, a sexual religion. There would be temple prostitutes that people would go up and they would sleep with. There would be, again, not trying to be gross and go into any of this, but there would be a shrine up there of goats, and so people would have relations with goats. Like, they would do all of these grotesque things in order to make Pan come back from the dead every year. And if Pan came back from the dead every year, they'd have prosperity. This is Caesarea Philippi, sitting on the gates of hell, sitting in a place with this religion that was grotesque and pagan. And then also inside of here, it's a Roman city, so therefore every other god you can think of is shown there, and people are able to worship those gods. Another picture of that area against the foothill, you've got to the left is the, that's the temple to Zeus, and then you've got a temple to Pan, and then you've got the sacred goats complex, and then you've got another one over there for Caesar Augustus, and then a whole bunch of other places for people to worship at. So when people would go and be in Caesarea Philippi, they could worship anything, do anything, and no one told them it was wrong. Back to our text. Jesus takes his guys from the Galilee, which is completely Jewish, and he walks them 2 to 3 days to the region of Caesarea Philippi to ask one question. We've been set up when we're reading this text for you to go, why would you do that? But I think sometimes we miss that. But let's jump into our reading here. So here's what it says. Chapter 16, verse 13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? They're going to answer him. They replied, some say John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets. These are great answers. Jesus says, hey, who are people saying that I am? And the disciples are like going, oh man, Jesus, you're a big deal. Some people think you're like Elijah or Jeremiah. I mean, if you're a Jewish person, these are like your heroes of the faith. These are like the guys, like my kids are getting into baseball, you know, and they talk about like Babe Ruth and these different people. These are who little Jewish boys and girls would talk about, like when they're talking about their heroes. You're like one of those guys, Jesus. But then Jesus turns the question on them a little bit and goes, hey, but who do you say that I am? And we got to love Peter. He's always the first to speak up. He's probably the oldest of the disciples. He quickly says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. What a great answer. Jesus, you're not just a prophet. You're the one who we've been waiting for. You are the Christ. You are the Messiah. You are the hope for our generation. You are the hope for all of Judaism. You are the one that we've been told about, and you are now here. Jesus replies, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by the Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Again, I'm not here to change your theology on anything, I mean, you've probably heard multiple times, like, oh, Peter gets his name changed from Simon to Peter. Petros means rock. Definitely means that. He says, Peter, your name is now rock. And then he says, but on this rock I will build my church. The wording doesn't necessarily say on Peter. It's going to be built on tons of different disciples over the years, tons of apostles. I think what he's saying is he's pointing at this place. I don't believe he was probably standing on it. I probably believe he was up on a hill somewhere overlooking Caesarea Philippi. But he makes a statement of going, and you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And guess what? The gates of Hades will not overcome it. What a profound statement to sit there and go, even the worst place on earth, Caesarea Philippi, the place of paganism, the place where you're not supposed to be, the place that is just overrun with people doing whatever they want that's against God, even on this place I will build my church. One of my favorite things of taking people here is I'll walk them right out on top of this area. And I'll start telling them about them. You see people getting uncomfortable because I would give them the non-church talk, which I just gave you. I go into a little bit more detail, and all of a sudden they're like, oh my goodness, you know, uncomfortable walking around, trying to get away from the sacred goats area, all of this different stuff. But I sit with the students and I go, and the people who are with me, and I go, can you believe this? Jesus comes to a place like this, the gates of Hades, right there, as people thought of it. And he makes a statement of saying, even in a place like this, Caesarea Philippi will not survive. Even the gates of hell are going to fall to what I've got coming. And he makes this amazing statement, and I sit there with people, and I go, guys, we're sitting in a ruin right now. Nothing exists in this place anymore. We're here seeing it. Most people are just walking around seeing a couple ancient ruins. But I'm sitting there with the church, and I go, we're the church, and we're here. The gates of hell did not prevail. God is doing a work, and we're standing in a place where he's done a work. It gives me goosebumps every time. And then we get a chance to, like, you know, say a prayer, you know, yell something loud, and I sit there and go, that's right. Satan, you didn't win in this spot. What God's got coming, Satan can't stop. And so this is one of those moments of a picture where he begins to say that. And I think Peter loved hearing that. Peter's like, right on, I'm on the right side. Jesus has a place for me. This is going to be awesome. And he says this, then he warned his disciples not to tell anybody that he was a Christ. And this could be a whole other theological talk we could do this week together. And you sit there and you go, they're just not ready yet to go out and tell people the full deal of who Christ is. So Jesus is like, okay, I'm giving you a glimpse of what this is all about. But don't go tell people yet because you don't really got it figured out. And you might sit there and go, well, that's not nice, but check out what happens next. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and on the third day he would be raised from the dead. So Jesus is sitting there, and he's just going, hey guys, here's the deal. Who do people say that I am? And people are sitting there going, hey, they say that you're these things. Who do you say that I am? We say you're God. Right on. If you say that I'm God, not even this place here is going to stand against what I got coming up. They're like, yeah, right on. But then he's like, but don't tell anybody. But then the next thing here, he's like, hey, by the way, guys, once we leave here, we're going to start making our way back to Jerusalem. I'm going to get killed. And all of a sudden, Peter's like, and this is what I love about Peter. Peter took him aside. So all of a sudden, he like grabs him like, hey, Jesus, over here. I know I just said you were God, but I need to talk to you. And he pulls him aside, and he says in the text, he rebuked him. Never, Lord, he said, this shall never happen to you. Who does Peter think he is? He just made a statement of saying that Jesus was God, and the next thing he's doing is he's giving God counsel on what he should and shouldn't do. This takes me to a place where I'm going to throw this out to you guys. In life, there are a lot of wise people. You know, I've had a chance going through school to read a lot of books, and I've read books by Confucius, I've read books by Muhammad, you know, the Quran, I've read a lot of different things, and there are a lot of wise people out there who say a lot of wise things. But you know what? They're not God. This is going to hurt some of you. C.S. Lewis is not God. There are some wise people who have wise sayings, but they're not God. So you read it, you take what is scriptural and what is true, and you kind of have to throw some of the rest of it out sometimes. That's what we do with normal people. But when we make a statement and say that somebody is God, then we don't get to pick and choose what we like about it. I meet Christians all the time who say Jesus is God, but they live as if he's just a prophet or a good person. I'll say that Jesus is God, but when it comes down to something I don't like, I just kind of forget about that and I do this over here. We don't get to live like that. Either Jesus is God or he's not. We don't get to pick and choose what our Christianity looks like based off of what we like and don't like that Jesus teaches. We have to follow him. And so for some of you who are sitting there who maybe are on staff or whatever, I go, who do you say that he is? Do you say that he's God? If he is, take a good look inside your life and make sure you're following him. Some of you maybe today are sitting out there going, I don't know this Jesus, and I don't know how to answer this question of who he is. Well, if that's true, come talk to us as well, because we'd love to tell you more about who he is, because we'd love for you to be able to have an opinion on that. Is he God? Is he not God? Because that, in my opinion, is the most important question in the entire text. Who is he? Because depending on how you answer that depends on what you do. Now, our actions are always dependent on what we believe, and so I love this analogy right here of this picture. This was taken a little while ago. This is with my children when they were younger, and this was here at Hume Lake. And so my children love to go jump on a trampoline. My wife actually gave me this analogy. She's like, you got to use this. And so they like to go, and they like to go jump on the trampoline when they were younger. And so this is little baby Ronan when he was small. He's 6 years old now, so he's not this small. And then Jaren and Ellie. And they would take him, and they would get on the trampoline and pulverize the guy. What you believe dictates your actions. If they actually believed that this little guy could get hurt and that he was a human, they might have treated him differently. But they're just like, oh, Mom, it's so cool. We just launched him. And he'd always come in crying. And like, what we believe dictates the actions of what we do. And when we say, if we believe in Jesus, that we believe that he is God, it will dictate the actions of what we do. So again, putting that out to you of just going, God, if he is God, is someone we need to follow. And if he's not God, then you're going to treat him differently. So good old Peter, he's showing us this moment. He totally gets Jesus on the side and goes, hey, man, I know I said you were God, but let me help you to understand how the story goes down. And I love what Jesus does to him right here. So great. He says, this shall never happen to you. And then Jesus turns and said to Peter, who he has just said, hey, your name is now the Rock. You're no longer Simon, but you are now the Rock. He now says this to him, get behind me, Satan, you are a stumbling block to me, and you do not have the mind of the things of God, but the things of men. Wow, Peter, you went from this moment of like elevated to boop, back to who you really are. And that's okay. Peter's going to figure this out. It's just going to take some time, and I love that because I'm still figuring it out. But then Jesus turns it around here, and he says this. Then Jesus said to his disciples, still sitting in the same place at Caesarea Philippi. Again, I imagine him sitting up on a hillside. And I like to do this when I take groups over there. They get real embarrassed by it, but we'll be up on a hillside, and then we'll just start yelling these things out. Because I can imagine him looking down at that rock area. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone were to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me will find it. I can see this part right here, yelling it out, of just going, what good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world, yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? Caesarea Philippi was the place of get whatever you want. He brings his guys to a location to ask that question. And while looking down at the people there, he's sitting there going, what are you willing to give up for your soul? I think it's a pertinent question to us today. How enticed are we by things of the world that we know aren't right? What are we willing to give up our soul for? I find that I'm willing to give it up for much less than it's worth. And that's the part of following Christ all the time, is just going, if he is God, then my life becomes a life of giving up of things that are not what I'm called to and embracing what Christ calls me to. That's the Christian walk. Is it easy? Not at all. I hate it when guys get up here and tell you, become a Christian and your life will be the easiest thing you've ever done. I sit there and I go, that guy's lying, because life isn't easy. God never promises it. What did he promise right here? If you're going to follow me, pick up your cross and let's go. It would be like saying to you guys right now, hey, everybody, we're going to follow Christ. We're going to go pick up an electric chair. Nobody wants that. Giving up of our life isn't something that I'm trained in my nature to do. But Christ says, if you're going to follow me, it won't be easy, but this is the path that we move forward on. Is it a path that's worth it? Yeah. If you spend time in the text here, you can definitely see that. I mean, Jesus makes a statement here, and he's going to make it as he leaves, of just going, you can give up everything for your soul, but what have you really gained? You've gained nothing. But following me, doing what I call you to, brings you to salvation. It brings you to redemption. It takes care of the problem at hand. And all the Jewish people understood it because they were used to the sacrificial system of life. Do this, do that. And it was always to sit there and say that no matter what you do, it's not good enough. It's going to take God taking care of the problem, and that is the Messiah. And so Jesus makes that place of going, follow me. The cool thing here is that the disciples, while they don't get it right now, they will get it later. God's working on his people. So this morning, as we kind of finish up, just that question for you guys. Who do you say that he is? And I don't want the Sunday school answer, because I've talked to too many people who have been Christians for too long who just go, he's God. Great. But are you living that? Does the fruit of your life show it? And if you're in a spot where maybe you need to make some changes, what a great place to do it here at Hume Lake. Or maybe, like we said, you're here for the first time, or you're hearing this and you're just going, I don't know how to answer that question. That's awesome too. What a great place to engage in that while we're sitting up here in a place that's beautiful and God's creation is everywhere and it speaks evidently that there is a God. But don't walk out of here not being able to wrestle with that question, because this question should change us every day. It should be a question we ask every day. Who is he? Who do I say that he is? I want to pray for us as we finish up, and I'd just love to invite you to join us this week, because this week we're going to take Jesus and we're going to look at him inside the context of the first century in which he taught, in which he did his miracles, in which he brought the greatest gift ever, which is salvation through a knowledge in him. We're just going to put them into context, and I hope you'll come out and have a good time with that. I hope you'll come out and we'll have some fun. We're going to do a couple maps if you're a map person. If you're not a map person, you don't have to, but I like maps. So we're going to do a couple maps. We're going to learn a bit. Hey, we'll even teach you some Hebrew while you're there, you know, because, you know, you might use that someday when you get to heaven, maybe, you know. I think they speak Hebrew there. But we'll just have a great time together being over in Memorial Chapel, which is just behind here, and having a chance to study God's Word together. So let me pray. Lord, thanks for this morning. Thanks for a chance to worship together. Thanks for the fact that you walk your guys 2 to 3 days to ask them a question that will be pertinent to all of our lives for the rest of our lives. May we be honest with how we answer it. May we be honest with how we live it. And God, may we not be enticed by a world that wants us to give up our soul for things that are not eternal, for things that basically take us our eyes off of you. May we learn to focus on you. May we learn to worship you with all that we do. We give you this morning, and we just pray for safety as all the campers come up, and just thank you for a chance to finish off with a song together as we finish our worship time. Amen.